On this episode of the DFA podcast, we talk about a trio of promising prospects who are heading to the majors. We ask, what in the world are the St. Louis Cardinals doing? And we talk about Billy Epler. It's the DFA podcast, and we're always craving moves.
Welcome to episode 28 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, is RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, how's it going? Happy Tuesday.
It is a happy Tuesday because John McPhee's book's out today, and I cannot wait to finish this and go dive into that.
Well, we will keep it short and sweet so that you can get into your reading. It's been a kind of a quiet Labor Day weekend. We don't have a lot to talk about in terms of guys moving from team to team, but we do have a number of call-ups to talk about. We missed on one last week when we were focused on all the big post-waiver deadline deals. So we're going to pick that one up. And then there's two more that were just recently announced that we're going to cover too. So we got young guys to talk about for a change.
Yes, for a change, as if we don't talk about young guys all the time, because, you know, me and you are very old and senile at this point. So
that's not even close to being true on one of our parts, at least. I know that you are an old man at heart, but you are young in body. So
I would just say we're missing our number one young guy, and Mr. Brody, who continues his tour of Cambodia. So
I was going to say, ironically, the young guy on our team is doing what young people do and learning things, which is probably good for him, I think.
Ben? Maybe. You never know.
So we'll open it up with three call-ups. We'll tackle two probably by themselves at first and then grab the third one. But we did want to cover the Alex Verdugo call-up with the Dodgers. And then just now, breaking in the last few hours, is that the Dodgers are also calling up another of their top prospects in Walker Buehler. So that's two guys who are probably, I don't know, they might be the top two prospects left in the Dodgers system, and now they're both joining the big team.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Dodgers preseason list, they're ranked number 4 and number 6, but they've obviously brought up Bellinger, they've traded DeLeon, and I don't know where you rank Yadier Alvarez at this point, but I think there's a pretty good case that Verdugo and Buehler are the top two, or at least two of the top three prospects in the Dodgers system. And obviously, both of these guys were mentioned a lot at the deadline in potential Yu Darvish trades or, you know, trades for other top names. They both have some interesting aspects to their game. I'll start with Verdugo, and I don't know how familiar you are with him. I'll be honest, I watched some video after he was called up, and that was my first real eyes-on exposure to him, which probably not a great thing, but, you know, I'm not a prospect guy. And he's interesting because, you know, it's all relying on the hit tool. He doesn't really have power potential. I think the most generous grade you're going to see for his power is like a 5, which, you know, in right field, that's not typically what you want to see, but that's also the best case scenario. It's probably more likely that he ends up in a, you know, the 40 to 45 range in terms of home run production. So, you know, it's all about the hit tool because he doesn't have a great amount of secondary tools either. Everything's like closer to average, and that's an interesting profile because, you know, if you look at some of the hit tool grades, they throw like a 7 out on his hit tool.
Right.
So, you know, that's pretty impressive. I guess I'll ask a general question, but it really, you know, includes Verdugo here. Does it ever concern you when you have a corner outfield prospect who is this reliant upon a hit tool?
Yeah, it does concern me a little bit because hit tool is always so hard to kind of get a really great beat on, even when you get to the major league level. I mean, we see a lot of times where prospect evaluators, if you miss a little bit on the hit tool, it dramatically changes a player's ceiling and their floor. Now, I'm not saying that Verdugo doesn't have a 7 or you know, higher hit tool or 7.5, something like that. But, you know, it's one of those things where, like you said, secondary skills, he's been playing some center field, but it doesn't look like he'll stay there long term. He does have a cannon arm, so that's, you know, it's not a very useful tool compared to, power or speed or something like that, but that's really the only other tool you're saying he has. So if he's a little off on the hit tool, maybe he's more like a six, then I don't know, you could be looking at somebody who's gonna top out as a fourth outfielder rather than somebody who could be a real regular in a corner outfield profile.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to me that the Dodgers did not trade him given the risk associated with the profile. Because this would seem like someone who, if in their opinion the hit tool was being a little overstated or overrated, they would have swapped him out by now. So I'm curious to see how he develops because if the Dodgers didn't trade him, that leads me to believe there's reason for that. And it's not just the case of them hoarding prospects because they were aggressive trading their prospects at the deadline. At least to some extent. So, yeah, I'm curious to see about Verdugo, and I really don't have a whole lot more to add about him. Do you?
I just had one quick thing, and that's I'm a little more okay with a guy who is like an all-hit, low-power profile in this offensive environment because the way that the ball has changed a little bit, maybe having less power and more hit tool could end up having a better offensive overall profile. Maybe you've got a guy who's going to hit 300, but with the changes in the way people are, putting balls over the fence, maybe he could be a 20 homer guy at some point relatively soon where maybe he wouldn't have been otherwise. So that's the only other thing where I'd be more willing to, just for the next year or two, kind of invest a little bit in hit tool heavy players.
That's an interesting point because I went to the Blue Jays Orioles game on Sunday and Brett Anderson was pitching and he was like 89 to 90 all day. And I was thinking in my head, 10, 15 years ago, that seems okay from a left-handed starter.
Yeah, right.
And nowadays, it feels like everyone is hitting mid-90s consistently. And I was just thinking about the scouting scale and at what point do we almost have to update that for today's standards? Because the game is so different with regards to velocity and power. And even, the hit tool has changed too. And I don't know, that's just something I was tossing around in my head because nowadays, if you have average velocity as a starter in terms of, a 5 grade on your fastball velocity, you don't actually have average velocity.
Right.
And, that's interesting. And let's use that to transition to the Dodgers' other call-up, Walker Buehler. You might know him because he went to Vanderbilt University. He was the 24th overall pick in the 2015 draft, underwent Tommy John surgery. He's, flew through the minors. He's a very interesting arm to me, in part because of his profile. He throws hard. He can get up to like 97, but he also has the chance for two above average pitches in his curveball and changeup. The interesting thing about him is that he really does not have a starter's frame in the sense that although he's listed at 6'2", he's pretty lean. And, there's always reservations about a guy's body when he's either short or super lean. Does that concern you any about his ability? Oh, let me rephrase that. Does the fact that he already has a zipper on his elbow and that he's a lean guy concern you any about his potential to handle a major league workload?
Yes, because I'm concerned about any pitcher who has any frame and a zipper on their arm and is young and went to a school like Vanderbilt where he pitched a lot of college innings. Those sorts of things always make me a little bit nervous. I don't know if I'm super, super worried about Buehler in the short to medium term, but in the long term, sure, because I always think of the Tim Lincecum comp. And I feel like, you have these guys with the smaller frames and the ability to throw incredibly hard. You can maintain that level of velocity and that level of performance for a while. But what I worry about is when it goes hard. And so if that's the case, he's going to come up as a reliever. They're going to try him out as a reliever before, obviously, they want him to be a starter, because that's the far more valuable use of Buehler. But I mean, I just figure he could be one of those guys who has a up and down or good career as a starter for 5 or 6 seasons, and then maybe you want to be more aggressive in shifting him back down to the bullpen before you see one of those dramatic injuries or dips in performance that you sometimes see with these guys.
That makes sense. I will say that I feel like I am a little bit more willing to give Buehler a longer leash than with someone like, Marcus Stroman or Sonny Gray, where I'm already thinking like, okay, do you shift them to the bullpen within the next, so many years or what have you, especially on Gray's part. because, he had that bad year last season where he missed time due to injury and he was ineffective and all. I don't like the Tim Lincecum comp for Buehler. And
Well, Lincecum is not a good comp for a lot of people. He's a very unique pitcher, so that's a good point.
yeah, but I feel like it's really lazy because, for one thing, Buehler is bigger than Lincecum. He's got like 3, 4 inches on him. And, that's if Lincecum was actually his listed height, which who knows.
Right.
For another thing, I feel like that's just the comparison that gets thrown on any right-handed pitcher who has an up-tempo delivery. Because, if you look at Buehler's delivery, it's really not Lincecum-like, other than the fact that he's really quick with it. He has a very good up-tempo delivery. I don't know, man. I feel like maybe, the guy we could be using here is Trevor Bauer in terms of frame and also the delivery. And of course, I don't know if you actually want to be compared to Trevor Bauer
Oh, sure.
because you know what I mean? Like, I know he's got the reputation as being a really, really intelligent pitcher, and I don't doubt that whatsoever, but I've always felt like with his stuff, he should be better than like a 98 career ERA plus. And it kind of mystifies me how we don't talk about him as like one of the game's great underperformers because I don't know. When I watch him, I'm like, this dude should be way better than he is. And that's probably unfair, but I don't know. Anyway, the point is, I do like Buehler. I watched him when he was a draft prospect, and I was like, yeah, I would definitely like to have him in my system if I were running a team. And, the Dodgers lucked out that he slipped to them in the draft, and they were able to get him signed. And even with the Tommy John surgery, I'm still optimistic that he has a future as at least a mid-rotation starter. And, who knows? We'll see about the durability aspects, but I think, like you said earlier, you can basically say these same things about every single pitcher or pitching prospect in the game.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and you're right in that maybe Lincecum isn't such a great comp because he's so unique and there isn't really anyone like him. And Buehler is taller, and that's accurate. The other thing though about Trevor Bauer as a comp that's tough is because Trevor Bauer has this very unique training regimen and he's very tweaky with a lot of his stuff. And Buehler, what's nice about him is he has possibly the best stuff in the minors right now, according to Baseball Prospectus, who put him as the number 19 prospect on their midseason list. He's already got 2 good breaking pitches, which is another reason why you definitely want to keep him in the rotation as long as you can. Because, I mean, how often do you see a guy with 3+ pitches already at his age and with his quality of stuff? I mean, you've got to try to run that out there as long as you can, I think.
Yeah, so let me ask this. Okay, we talked about these two Dodger prospects. Of the two, who do you like more going forward? Like, who for you is going to amass more WAR or, whatever metric of choice you want to throw out here over the next, let's just say over the course of their team control, so over their first 6 major league seasons.
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. I'm going to go with Buehler. I think he's a better overall player. However, if you had said over the course of their major league careers, I would have gone with Verdugo because given his skill, his leading skill being his hit tool, I have a feeling he's going to have a long major league career, if not necessarily as productive as Buehler's. Whereas, those types of players tend to get passed around quite a bit because teams always want to have a contact guy coming off the bench, I feel like. But over the short term, I mean, Buehler's got a higher ceiling than Verdugo by quite a bit, I think. So I'm gonna bet on his ceiling, even though there's a much higher likelihood that he'll be injured or ineffective.
Who just came to mind when you were talking about Verdugo? Nick Markakis. I don't
Yeah,
know
it'd be
about
great if he was a Nick Markakis. That's a heck of a
right.
career to have, man.
Absolutely. I don't know. I'm just throwing that one out there because that's what the skill set reminds me of, strong arm and contact and on-base percentage over slugging out of a corner. But to answer the question, I think I'd go with Buehler as well. Although I'm a little hesitant now because, if he is Nick Markakis, that's a pretty good career. That said, I'm going to stick with Buehler. And I think it's time we transition to the other call-up we were going to talk about. The Phillies are bringing or have brought shortstop prospect J.P. Crawford to the majors. And it's been a weird year for Crawford. He entered the season, I believe he was like a universal top five prospect across all the rankings and really had a rough first half. If you look at his numbers in AAA this season, he hit 242, 350, 399. Technically, that's above average production for that league. However, when you're a top five prospect in baseball, we expect a lot more from you than just above average in AAA. So, what do you make of Crawford? Are you a little lower on him than you were entering the season, or do you just kind of shrug off some of the struggles he had early on and say, you know what, he's a 22-year-old shortstop. These kind of tools don't come around that often, or, you know, what's your perspective on him, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, it's funny, I actually was lucky. I got to see Crawford in person at Paw Sox versus Iron Pigs game a week ago, and it was funny because I was talking to my wife there, and I said, oh, this is the best prospect who's going to be playing in this game, and it's one game and one showing, but he didn't really stand out in such a way that it was obvious his tools, defensively or offensively, in one quick look, did not stand out the same way you would expect with somebody with his background as a top prospect. Now, if you look at the Baseball Prospectus midseason top 50, he had fallen all the way to 20. So we are a little bit of a ways away from his heyday as a top prospect. I'm not, the world's greatest scout or anything. I still think he's got all the tools to be a successful major leaguer, but I'm not sure he has that superstar ceiling anymore. I just don't know if his combination of hit and power is going to ever play up to be something much above average. He did pick things up a little bit the second half, or actually picked things up a lot in the second half in Lehigh Valley, but and his defense will play. He's just a really kind of a confusing player to me right now, and the way that the Phillies have been moving him around the diamond a little bit, I'm not sure how well that bodes for him. It's good to have positional flexibility, and I'm a big fan of positional flexibility, but I'm not real confident that if they put him, say, for example, at third base, I don't see that profile playing up at all to be a good player. If they want to move him around a little bit, maybe that's a good thing, but I would kind of like to see if you have a guy with this much talent at shortstop, you keep him at shortstop, especially for the early part of his career. I know that the Phillies have other players in their infield who they consider quality players in Galvis and Cesar Hernandez, but I kind of think that now they're in a position where they should run Crawford out there at shortstop and let him, give him a full run to see what he's got before they move on from him in that position, I would say.
Yeah, and that's kind of confusing to me too. And I wonder if it was a case where they wanted to get his mind off things, maybe at the plate, by moving him around, giving him a different challenge to focus on. Because otherwise, I don't really understand that. And admittedly, I haven't seen him. Again, I'm just not a prospect guy. I don't go out there scouting this kid. But, you know, because the thing about his report is that, you know, they say he's a borderline plus-plus shortstop. I'm thinking in my head, why would you move him for Freddy Galvis? You know, you're not going to move this dude for Freddy Galvis. And yeah, the power is supposed to be his weakest tool. And I know his power production was up this season. He actually homered 14 times as opposed to 7 times last year. And just eyeballing, it looks like his previous career high in the minors was like 11. So he set a new career high in home runs. He does walk a lot. He doesn't strike out too much more than he walks. So that's interesting. Of course, you know, this could be a case where he has Aaron Hicks disease and he's passive at the plate or what have you. Again, without seeing him, I can't say that, but you know, that would interest me if he's perhaps working too deep in the counts and leaving himself, well, betraying himself by not swinging at hittable pitches. But again, I don't know. That's just an observation from looking at the numbers. Yeah, I'm interested to see him. Again, I don't have too much exposure to him outside of, you know, cursory video glances to see what his swing looks like, to see if he's changed anything. But let's talk about the Rockies. Let's talk about the Phillies a little bit more. What are your thoughts on this rebuild now? Because I feel like it's starting to go sour for most people.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from with that. Like the rebuild has not yet produced one or more of the star type players you'd really like to see. Now I'm going to throw out a quick caveat there. Aaron Nola is great. He is a really, really great pitcher, and I think he's, if not an ace, like a pretty solid two or three starter. So he may be just under that floor of star, but he's close. Rhys Hoskins, still don't know. Could be great, could not be. But The Phillies also have done some kind of weird things in their rebuild. In addition to maybe not being so fortunate with some guys coming through, like, Michael Franco looks like maybe he's not the exactly the player they were hoping it would be. Right now, they're putting out there on a regular basis some players who it's kind of weird for them to do that, I feel like. They've got a lot of talent that's kind of in that we don't know if they're going to be a really good AAA player or they're going to be a really good major league player level. And yet they're still giving like a ton of time to Tommy Joseph at first base instead of putting Hoskins there and running somebody else out in the outfield. Especially now that Aaron Alther's coming off the disabled list, I would imagine that he'll go back to getting some time in the outfield. But you gotta figure that with him and Freddy Galvis, up to this point getting all the reps at shortstop, and maybe it would have been better to bring Crawford up earlier, or maybe not, but there's some open questions there. Jorge Alfaro is up on the major league roster, but doesn't seem to be getting a ton of time behind the plate. I'm kind of confused if the front office and the field staff and the development staff are all kind of working in concert, and that does kind of make me worried about the status of a rebuild. And that's even before we start talking about the pitching staff, which I think might be its own issue.
Yeah, and I thought that Jeffrey Paternostro had an interesting piece last week on Mickey Moniak and how he didn't necessarily stand out when you were looking at, I don't even remember the team they were playing. I think it was maybe, oh man, you know what? I'm not, oh, it was, I think, a Rangers affiliate because I think Mike Petula was involved. But yeah, he didn't necessarily stand out, and that's not really what you want to hear about the number one pick, just a year over. Just over a year into his professional career. And in fact, if you look at his numbers, he's hitting 236, 284, 341 in A ball with 109 strikeouts and 509 plate appearances. So, yeah, that's probably not a good sign, even though he's young and it's early and all. But yeah, I guess the other good thing the Phillies have going for them, and you didn't mention him because, there's no point in mentioning him just yet with regards to the Major League team, is a fella named Sixto Sanchez,
Oh, yeah,
who,
Sexto.
of course, we just talked about Tim Lincecum, and we talked about, smaller pitchers and the risk that they bring. And we're talking now about a pitcher who is listed at 6 foot, 185 pounds. But boy, does he throw hard, and boy, could he be something if he's able to stay healthy and continue to refine his command and the rest of his pitches. But that's the situation with the Phillies right now. There's going to be a lot of waiting and seeing. It's just seemingly not in a good position and seemingly not in the position that a lot of people were hoping for at this point last year.
I'll just point out real quickly about the pitching situation. Like, Sixto's great, and it would be wonderful to see him, carry on these gains that he's made into the majors. But none of the rest of their pitchers that they were supposed to have gotten as like great young talents seem to be coming through very well. Like the guys they targeted in trades, I guess, more. The
You're talking
Mark
about Jake Thompson.
Jake Thompson, absolutely, but also Mark Appel. I mean, he was a question when they acquired him to begin with. Vince Velasquez, unfortunately, has been injured when he has gotten the opportunity to pitch through those injuries. So yeah, it's just one of those things. Zach Eflin has not been what they want to see in injured, and it makes me a little nervous. I don't know if, trying to acquire pitchers seems to be just completely a crapshoot, and that's not probably the way I would want to rebuild.
The Braves way,
The Mets way, all of them.
the
Anytime you
National League East way,
yeah.
except for the Marlins, who just trade their useful pitching prospects for whatever. So,
And now it looks a little less than ideal, given what we've heard about that team going forward. But that's a topic for
speaking
another
of a
time.
little less than ideal, I think we can transition now to everyone's favorite part of the show. Not batting practice, but Ryan ranting about the Mets
Yeah,
because
really.
the good old Mets went out and signed veteran outfielder Nori Aoka, who had been, who had previously been with both the Astros and Blue Jays this season. He was designated for assignment, and he ended up hitting the free agent bin a little early. Brian, what do you think about Nori Aoka and his fit on the Mets?
I think he's a good fit for the Mets. I think that this is the type of fourth, or maybe in the case of the Mets, a fifth outfielder that would be useful to this team next year. So, and they were so desperate for anybody who's just a warm body who can play major league quality baseball in the corner outfield position at this point with the injuries that they've had, that I think this is just a fine pickup. He's cheap. He's going to be, you know, available, freely available in the market next offseason. Why not go ahead and get a guy like this who can do some things, you know, make some contact, and have him around for the end of this season and coming into next season, hopefully to audition for a spot? I think this is a fine move. The small moves are not always the problems the Mets have. They tend to be sometimes with the bigger moves. So it's definitely TBD. It's not going to change their trajectory next season at all, but it might be an extra win that they picked up here rather than, you know, trying to run Travis Tyheron out there next season as a fifth outfielder.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I am very confused as to how teams value Nori Aoki, because I've been a fan for years now, and I remember when he became a free agent, I ranked him fairly well in the top 50. You know, I thought he was a pretty solid player, and he just did not get that kind of contract. And I believe I used to, you know, run the numbers on the contracts given to these guys, like the annual average value versus their rank, just to see like who did I miss the most on according to the market. And I think he was always or was one of the top ones. And I just can't figure out why he bounces around so much, because throughout his career, he's been pretty consistent at the plate. You know, you're talking about a guy who this is his sixth big league season. Well, assuming he finishes around the mark he is now, he's never going to have the OPS plus lower than 99. Granted, he's never been higher than 109, but there's value in having a consistently average hitter. Last I checked of his splits, he didn't really have a significant platoon split. I think he actually had reverse splits, which I don't know if that's, you know, sustainable or whatever, but that's useful. I know his defense doesn't always look pretty. However, for his career, he's actually been a positive fielder if you trust Baseball Reference's fielding metric. And even if you don't trust it entirely, his career low was negative eight. Otherwise, he's been in the negative five or better range. So I don't know if this is a case where Aoki just fails the eye test completely, and he's just not good enough to overcome the, let's say, instinctual reaction to someone who fails the eye test as much as he does. But it's really confusing to me how, you know, he can go through all these smart front offices. Like the Brewers, you know, they traded him for Will Smith, so you kind of get that one. You know, the Giants, they're smart, and they were like, okay. The Mariners are smart, and they were like, okay. And you know, this year he was with the Astros and Blue Jays, two of the teams who are most likely, I think, to eschew the eye test. And now he's with the Mets, another team who has, you know, the OGs of sabermetric analysis. And I don't know if he's going to be there next season or not. You know, that's an open question to me because I just don't know how they value him. But, you know, what am I missing about this guy that makes him just bounce around when it seems like he should be a solid fourth or fifth outfielder for cheap?
Well, that's the thing that's kind of interesting is I think some of it has to do with his contract situation is that he seems to, or he or his agent seem to seek out these shorter term contracts. I remember in 2015 when he signed with the Giants before the season, there was some talk that he had taken that offer from the Giants, even though there were more lucrative offers out there. Because that contract in 2015 they signed with the Giants, I think it was for something like $4 million, to sign with the Giants coming off that World Series win. And I remember some discussion about the fact, like, this seems like a ridiculous contract because, just like you were saying, all these skills that he has, he was a above average, decidedly above average outfielder, by almost any metric at that point. But I do think there were some other considerations that came into him taking that contract. And then he signs with Seattle, another team that was on the West Coast, seemed like it would be a good fit, and he had another good season. This year with the Astros, he was bad. Like, I don't think he was nearly the hitter that he had been in any of his previous seasons. So that's why I can understand the Astros cutting bait on him. They also have all those outfielders who are young and easily kind of replaceable, and getting some of those reps in for those other outfielders, I think, might have been a priority for this Astros team. But his on-base percentage was down like 25 points this year for the Astros, and if his on-base percentage isn't really, you know, good in that 350 range, like you were talking about, those other secondary skills, he's not a great outfielder, he's not a good base runner, so all of a sudden that really kind of tanks his value. I mean, I think Baseball Prospectus had him almost a win below replacement for the Astros this year. The Blue Jays, though, I have no idea why they would have cut bait on him because he was playing okay for them and he seemed to fit that team. So I don't know why they decided to make that move, but some other teams gain, I guess.
Yeah, and I will note that it looks like a smart pickup on the Mets' part. They are dealing with a lot of outfield injuries. They also dealt Jay Bruce and Curtis Granderson. So if you haven't been following along with the Mets, their outfield, their starting outfield, I should say, the last, I believe, three games now has been Brandon Nimmo, Juan Lagares, and Aoki. So that's the situation that they are dealing with. Some other teams are dealing with more interesting situations, I think. Sorry, Brian. Sorry, Brody, wherever you are.
Understandable. It
That
isn't
would
that
be
interesting.
the Pittsburgh Pirates, who claimed left-handed pitcher Jack Leversich off waivers from the Cubs. Of course, Leversich used to be a member of the Mets, which is why he's most associated with being hurt and ineffective. So, Ryan, what do you think of the Pirates going out here and getting an interesting left-handed reliever?
I mean, I've always been a big guy for Jack Leathersich. He did not have the season that I think the Cubs were kind of hoping he would have this year, coming off of he was very badly overworked in the Mets minor league system and blew out his arm. But he's a left-hand pitcher who can throw very, very hard. He's always had phenomenal strikeout rates in the minor leagues. It's just that, with some of these guys, he has only the slightest idea of where the ball's going. His walk rate is just stupid high, and it always has been. He pitched well with Iowa this year. I just think the Cubs have way too many guys who are contenders for their 40 man, so somebody's got to go. And if you're going to find your command somewhere, the Pirates are a pretty decent place to go look for it. So he's one of those guys where he's just an adjustment away from being like a really dominant left-handed setup guy, but he's also just an adjustment away from being completely unrosterable, like even at the AAA level. So he's one of those high-risk, high-reward guys. When you're the Pirates and you have no future, like really, to contend in that division, go after these high-risk, high-reward guys and see what you got and hope you hit a winner.
Yeah, and I was going to make a joke about how Felipe Rivero fit a similar profile a few years ago, but he really didn't. He had much more control in the minors, and he did not get these kind of strikeout totals. Just to add some perspective to Leversich's performance in AAA this season, in 41 games, he threw 44 innings. He struck out 14.6 per nine and walked 5.7 per nine. You don't need to know any other numbers there because that kind of tells the whole story. Not sure what the Pirates see there in terms of what they could tweak. I'm sure there's something that in a year's time we could be saying, oh, of course, that's what they tweaked. That's why he's a dominant setup man now. Or like Brian said, in a year we could be saying, hey, let's see what the Padres can do to tweak Leversich and see if they get the most out of him. It's an interesting get. I like it for the Pirates because what does it hurt to take a chance on him? It's not like the Joaquin Benoit trade where I have no idea what they're doing there. This is more like, yeah, this is old school Pirates. Go out there, get an interesting arm for cheap, and see if you can't turn him into, a useful reliever. So I
He's
like
a
that.
two true outcomes pitcher. Like it's either going to be a walk or a strikeout. There's like no middle ground with him, which is pretty bonkers.
You think that the spirit that possessed Carlos Marmol has moved to Jack Leversich, and he's like, you know what? I want to stay in the game, so I'm going to go to a lefty this time and tweak, experiment a little bit because that would be a fun little story. Carlos Marmol wasn't actually wild; it was just whatever spirit had nabbed him at the time. That's how off the rails we're getting here because these moves are just kind of boring. We're just going to be saying, interesting get. I like that, even if it's not a high value one over and over for the rest of the show. So
I was going to
stay with
say,
us, folks.
do you want to talk about another left-handed reliever that was claimed off waivers? Because I think we could do that.
And another left-handed reliever who was claimed off waivers, who is going to the great state of Pennsylvania at bat, right?
Wow. I mean, that's some synchronicity.
Yep, Kevin Segrist, excuse me, was claimed off waivers by the Phillies. You probably know him from his work in the past as a seemingly decent setup man for the Cardinals. I mean, if you look at his 2015, 2016 numbers, it looked like he was pretty good. His ERA was 2.44, and I know everyone is groaning at the mention of ERA. However, he also had a 2.60 strikeout to walk ratio. That's 10 strikeouts per nine, four walks per nine. Kind of a similar profile to Leversich in the respect that the strikeouts had to make up for the walks, and he didn't really give up a lot of hits. So I'm a little surprised that the Cardinals cut bait on him. He had been wilder this season. Strikeout to walk ratio was down, but he'd given up, a home run per nine, which is what he'd given up in the previous two seasons combined. And I don't know. This is an interesting one for me because I know he always had issues with reverse splits, and we were wondering when he was going to develop a better breaking ball to become fiercer against lefties and whatnot. And I don't know. It's just surprising me that the Cardinals would cut bait after what amounted to like 34 rough innings.
Yeah, that is kind of strange. Last season, he wasn't quite as good as his ERA might have tried to tell us, I feel like. You can talk about batting average on balls in play, I think, a little bit for him. Last year, he had a 2.21 BABIP, and so he had that really low under 3 ERA, but his DRA said that he was not nearly that good. He was, had a 4.43 DRA, which is a lot more along the lines of league average. Well, this year the batting average on balls in play has gone completely in the other direction. He has a 3.44 batting average on balls in play. So he's got like a 5 ERA and a 6 DRA. And so I think what we might be seeing here is one, maybe the Cardinals know something about the health of his arm. I think that's the obvious thing here. He's people are making a lot more contact. They're a lot making a lot better contact, and his command seems to have dipped out a little bit on him. So to me, that's when a guy's let go. And all those things are happening, I start to think, okay, maybe he's trying to play through something.
Yeah, and I just want to add one more note about Segrist here. So this year, according to Baseball Reference, 7% of his fly balls have been of the infield variety. If you look at his previous, he played pitching part of four seasons. If you look at the rate through those four seasons, 19% of his fly balls were infield flies. And that's not just because of one weird season, like 17, 18, 19, then 21%. So he was really, really good at getting infield flies until this season, and that might speak to what you're saying. He might be hurt and might not be able to locate his fastball where he needs to locate it in order to get underneath barrels, or it could just be a case where maybe his fastball isn't effective enough to, cause that kind of weak contact. I don't know the case. Honestly, I didn't watch a lot of him throughout the year, just for whatever reason. I never seemed to catch him pitching. But I do like this claim anyway for the Phillies because for the same reasons I said about the Pirates, what do they have to lose? Claim a guy who in the past has been effective, even if only superficially so. And who knows? He's not in a situation where he's probably going to be making too much money. And he's not a free agent until after the 2019 season. So if they're able to get him back to where he is seemingly an effective left-handed setup man, then come next deadline or even come the winter, I doubt it's going to only take a month to regain his value. But come next deadline, who knows? They might be able to swap him for an even more interesting piece. And we'll be saying, wow, the Phillies were really smart to take a chance on Segrist off waivers last September.
Yeah, I don't think that's out of the question at all. I'm a little confused about what the Cardinals are doing in general with their roster these days, because this doesn't seem like, just like you said, I don't feel like this move was a move that was something that needed to be made. They have, yes, this is a team that has a lot of left-handed pitching in their bullpen, especially now, but I just don't know. Like you were saying about the cost, what he's going to get maybe $2 million after arbitration this year if he doesn't get DFA'd. And the guys that the Cardinals have are Zach Duke and Brett Cecil, who are big, off-season acquisitions that they made at different points over the last couple of seasons, but aren't likely to stick around with the team for too much longer.
Tyler Lyons has been good though.
Lyons has been good, yeah, but you need multiple lefties, and Ryan Sheriff might be fine and might not be. It's just they seem like this is not nearly as deep of a team as it used to be in the past, and I'm starting to get a little nervous that the devil magic might be wearing off or something for this team.
That's what they want you to think, Brian.
Yeah, they're lulling me into a false sense of security. That's a good point.
Yeah, but no, I definitely get your point. This is going to be a roster that I feel like is just in the beginning phases of an overhaul. Because, if you read Lance Lynn's comments following the Mike Leake trade, they have not talked to him about an extension. And he did not seem inclined to take a hometown discount or even necessarily re-sign before free agency gets here. And I have to feel like another team is going to pay him more than the Cardinals are willing to pay him if they aren't even approaching him at this point. And maybe that's a bad read of the situation, but it feels like they are going to turn over things to some of their younger pitchers, whether it's, Luke Weaver or Jack Flaherty or, Sandy Alcantara. I don't know if they're going to, I don't want to say concede next season, but I will note that this is the second instance now where the Cardinals are shedding pitching and shedding salary. And I know they didn't shed in the entirety of Mike Leake's contract, but it makes me wonder if they intend to make a splash in free agency this winter, or if this is a case where they're like, you know what, let's get leaner, let's, use next season as a bridge year and then go for it in 2019. That said, man, I don't know. Like, is that a smart move when your core is, I mean, just to read some ages here. Yadier Molina is 34, or in his age 34 season. Mac Carpenter is 31. Dexter Fowler is 31. Even Tommy Pham, who I think has been, the pleasant breakout star of that roster, well, he's in his age 29 season. So it's not like your core is young and youthful, and you can look 2 to 3 years down the road and say, hey, we're still going to be in a good position. You can only say that about their pitching staff if you buy into Weaver, who is 23, and Flaherty's 21, and Alcantara is 21. But as we said earlier, pitchers are risky, and especially young pitchers who we don't have a whole lot of data to prove. Oh, he can handle a major league workload. He can handle the stress that you incur throwing more high leverage innings in the majors than you ever did in the minors. And I don't know, man. Like you said, that roster is in a weird spot, and I'm not entirely sure what they are doing at this point. If they're letting seemingly cheap pieces like Segrist go with no return, because to be frank, the Phillies made what feels like a Cardinals move, claiming a guy, who's like a tweak or two potentially away from being a good reliever again. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the Cardinals may be looking to make a splash in free agency, which they did last year when they signed up Dexter Fowler. I feel like that was kind of the splash. So I'm just looking at what their contracts are going to look like for next year. And you have coming off the books, you have most of Mike Leake's salary coming off the books. You have whatever's left owed to Johnny Peralta coming off the books, Lance Lynn's contract, and then a couple of smaller ones. You've got ones to like Zach Duke, the final boss, Sung Wan Oh, Jonathan Broxton, and Brian Peña coming off. And then in terms of arbitration, yes, they have to start paying Randall Grichuk, which probably won't be too much. Michael Wacha's in line for an arb raise. Segrist was in line for an arb raise. And then Trevor Rosenthal, who honestly, I don't know what they're going to do there, if he's a non-tender candidate or if they want to move on from him somehow. So I'm looking at all of this and I'm seeing that maybe we're going to get, I don't know, something like $30 million coming off the books. Maybe, something a little bit less than that, depending on what Waka gets in arbitration. And what kind of splash are they going to make in that free agency pool is my question, because if you look at that, they have a lot of holes left to fill. Like, I would think they need multiple starting pitchers. I mean, maybe they're all in on the young guys, but I would think they need some depth there. And then it looks like they could use an outfielder. Tommy Pham, yes. But the combination of Grichuk and Piscotty in the outfield hasn't really worked out. They're still running Luke Voit out there at first base every day. So yeah, if they go out and they pick up a good corner bat as and a starting pitcher, that might be the entirety of a splash in free agency. So I'm just kind of, I'm not sure what that would end up being. And then their bullpen looks relatively weak. So yeah, I don't know where they're going.
Yeah, and I'll just add one more point before we move away from them. They signed Stephen Piscotty to that extension, which at the time looked like a good deal, while he was supposedly floated to the A's in a potential Sonny Gray trade. So there's a case where even though they were getting an established and quality major league pitcher in return, they were still trying to move some of the money that they have locked up long term. So whether this is, a case where the Cardinals are just trying to reduce their budget, or excuse me, reduce their payroll, or maybe they just didn't like Piscotty as much as they thought they did. I don't know, but interesting times in St. Louis and interesting times in Seattle, in part because they're 69 and 69, which gives every Twitter user great joy, and in part because they made a pair of waiver claims from the same team. The Cubs, man, they're getting picked clean here. It seems like the Mariners claimed outfielder Jacob Hanneman and pitcher Seth Frankoff from the Cubs, and DePoto being DePoto, he just has an appetite for these fringe outfielder types. And I'm going to start with Hanneman, and I'll let you tackle Frankoff because I don't really know that we have a lot to say on both guys. I mean,
Sure.
yeah, Hanneman, he's 20, in his age 26 season. He's a speedster. There's athleticism there. However, doesn't really have a whole lot else to offer. And he hit 240, 312, 372 across two levels in the minors this season. The Mariners have had some success claiming or trading for these sort of like fringe or on the bubble outfielders before. I mean, Ben Gamel has been pretty good for them. I know he's doesn't have this, sexiest overall line, but I think relative to what the expectations were, he's done well. Same with Mitch Haniger, and to some extent, same with actually, I guess that's it because Guillermo Heredia's numbers are not as impressive as I thought they were anymore. So sorry, Guillermo. I guess I kind of set you up for the fall there. So what about Seth Frankoff?
Well, I'll just quickly jump in on Hanneman for a little bit. He's like a poor man's Ben Gamel, which is like a really, really broke person's Mitch Haniger. Hanneman is like the problem with Hanneman is his age. Like he put up these good numbers in the minors, which is great, but isn't he going into like his age 27 season or something like that? So it's really hard to consider him anything like a prospect. To me, he seems like an org depth guy. And I think that's kind of what you were saying too. So as
But
far
not
as
in a concise way, not in a clean, concise way, so.
as far as Frankoff goes, hey, that term organizational depth applies here too. He's a 29-year-old. The thing about him is he's made 21 starts for AAA Iowa, and that's really, I think, what the Mariners need now is they need people who can make starts as organizational depth because they've had so little luck with starting pitching these last couple of seasons. He doesn't stand out really. I mean, he has this season, but there's nothing in Frankoff's profile that says that he's going to be anything more than a swingman AAA starter. He's 29. He just turned 29 about a week ago. He did have really good minor league DRA numbers this year, but they're minor league DRA numbers. They are what they are, which is not incredibly indicative of future performance. What's more indicative is, a scouting report, and the scouting reports on this guy have never been incredibly good. So he is a guy who will probably anchor their AAA rotation if he's not due for AAA free agency, minor league free agency. But that's really all you should expect from him.
Yeah, and to be clear, I think these moves are fine. You need to build organizational depth, and if you're clicking off a team's 40-man roster, the Cubs probably aren't a bad place to go shopping. That said, I wanted to make this point about Frankoff because you said, he's never really been thought of as more than an organizational arm. He is 29 years old. He's been in the Cubs system. Well, he hasn't been in the Cubs system too long. This is actually his first season there, but he's been in a couple other systems like the Dodgers, for instance, and the Brewers. Excuse me, I think it was the Athletics, and he's never actually been in the BP annual. And you got to remember, like, the annual covers what, 60 to 70 players per team. And when you've never made the BP annual, even though you've bounced around various teams, especially teams that are well thought of with regards to landing minor league gyms or what have you, that's probably not a good sign. That
No,
said,
no.
again, I don't mind it. DePoto, like you said, has to build some organizational depth, especially on the pitching side. And I guess it's okay to take a shot on a guy who, although he hasn't really stood out, has been a consistently decent minor league performer. And he averaged like 93 miles per hour on his fastball in his major league appearances. So that's not, it's not like we're talking about a guy who's throwing like 87 here. There's the potential for him to maybe slide into the bullpen and be a little bit more effective, or at minimum be a better spot starter than some of the arms they ran out there this year. So.
No question. I think that's a good breakdown of him. And you mentioned he's never been in the annual. He's not only never been in the annual, he's never been written up at Baseball Prospectus in any form whatsoever. Never an article, never a chat, never a prospect roundup or a minor leaguers of note thing. So he is completely invisible to the Baseball Prospectus world, which is actually kind of a challenging task at this point.
Yeah, and speaking of being completely invisible to the world, it's time to talk about the Angels. And our favorite topic, or my favorite topic at least, is talking about Billy Epler's affinity and ability to get these underrated relievers. And that leads us to their latest move, which is claiming Dayan Diaz off waivers from the Astros. Fun fact here, the Angels allowed Cameron Maybin to go to the Astros off waivers, and to make room for Maybin on the roster, the Astros designated Diaz for assignment. So we sort of had a trade here, even though it's not actually a trade. And that's always fun. With Diaz, I mean, you probably know what I'm going to say before I even say it, because at this point, Epler kind of has a type, and his type is a guy who can throw, let's say, a 95 mile per hour fastball that has some rise on it. And that's about all you can really say about Diaz, I think. He really hasn't had He really hasn't had that much major league time, and he certainly has not had success when he's been in the majors. But, I don't know, Ryan. You got anything to add here? Because this is a case where you're kind of looking at the minor league performance, you're looking at the profile, excuse me, and you're saying, well, maybe he does turn into a decent middle reliever, but he's certainly not such a sure thing that the Reds or Astros are likely to miss him because he's 28 years old. I thought he was actually years younger, so
Yeah, he I was just doing some I actually literally was just looking up Dian Diaz's peripherals and his background for a separate project like the day before this move was announced. His calling card in the minors was not giving up home runs. And so both times when he was called up to the majors, he gave up a boatload of home runs. So this is exactly what you worry about when you call a guy up and you make the jump from AAA to the majors. He only has a limited window to prove himself, and he did the exact opposite of what he was supposed to do. Like, I think either the Reds or the Astros would have been perfectly fine with giving him a job if he would just not give up home runs. And over the course of less than 20 major league innings, he's given up five. So that just does not bode well. He does have a great, split other than the home runs in his time with Houston this year. He struck out the world. He didn't walk too many people, but it's a small sample size. You got to assume that this guy is going to, be a fringy kind of reliever, and that's it. Because, sometimes you just lose that thing that makes you special in the jump from the minors to the majors, and he'll catch on somewhere. It's very possible the Angels will give him a shot next year, and he'll be just like you said, the Billy Epler special, where he'll stop giving up homers and do what he did in the minors, and we'll all be like, well, they did it again. They got a great seventh inning guy out of the deal.
Yeah, or it's possible he just keeps giving up more than two home runs per nine, and we start talking about him as the AJ Preller special because he throws 95 miles per hour and has zero business being in the majors. But anyway,
That might be even more likely.
yes, I think that's all we have. I mean, it really has not been a busy week, which is kind of to be expected. There's been a lot of promotions that we didn't touch on, but we're only two men here. With Brody around, we wouldn't have been able to tackle every single promotion in the sport, but he's left us, and we're hurting. We're really hurting.
And also, just to throw this out here real quickly, I was going to mention it during the talk that we had at the opening of the show, but are there any prospects left in the minor leagues? It feels like everybody is getting called up, and the churn rate for minor leaguers is really high right now. I mean, we had a mid-season prospect list at Baseball Prospectus, and I'm counting, almost half the guys on that list in the top 20 have already been called up to the majors.
I feel like you're trolling me here.
I'm not trolling you at all. I
Because
just
Brett Honeywell has not been called to the majors, and he's one of the ones who like makes the most sense to bring up, so
I mean, you're absolutely right in that this is just really bizarre why he hasn't, but
he was suspended for four games for discipline reasons, and who knows the story there. I mean, he's a
change of
wildcat.
scenery candidate, I think. The Rays would be better off moving him to a different org and getting something close to equivalent value back, maybe one of those prospect for prospect trades, but
Maybe they can get like Tobias Myers or someone like that in return. And, whatever happened to the guy they traded for Tobias Myers, by the way, I don't even remember his name. Do you? I don't.
for Tobias Myers? No, no
Yeah, what was
clue.
his name? I think he was just like a relevant dude, and I don't even think he's in the majors. Certainly not getting his own t-shirt day for the Orioles or anything. So, on that note, I think that's about all we have for you today. I am RJ Anderson, and he is Brian Grosnick. You can find him at Baseball Prospectus. You can find me at CBS. And thank you for listening.
See you next time.